Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
This episode is brought to you by Prep Starts Now, because life doesn't come with a warning. When an emergency strikes, whether it's a power outage, natural disaster, or even a medical scare, the last thing you want is panic. Prep Start Now empowers families to be ready with the right tools, knowledge, and confidence. They're about smart planning so you can focus on protecting your family instead of scrambling for solutions. Their shop has everything from first aid kits and water filtration to backup power and essential gear. Plus, their Prep Academy makes it easy to learn emergency skills with simple guides and quick tips anyone can follow. I've arranged an exclusive 15% discount for my listeners. Just go to PrepStartsNow.com and use promo code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, or click the link in my show notes where the discount is applied automatically. Don't wait for the next crisis. Take action today. That's PrepStartsNow.com. Promo code ZEROSIGNAL.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Tonight, we're talking about the intersection of intelligence, security, and the systems that keep modern life running, critical infrastructure, business continuity, and what happens when things start to break under pressure. My guest, KC Campbell, a veteran of the U.S. intelligence community and security and resiliency expert who's worked across government and the private sector. He's dealt with high-stakes threats, complex geopolitical risk, and a kind of worst-case scenarios most of us never see. KC, thanks for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Looking forward to this discussion.
For our listeners who may not know your story, how did you first get into intel and security, and what path led you to work you're doing today?
Sure. From a young age, I was interested in two things, flying and intelligence, and maybe a tertiary one is security. And when you combine both flying and intel, that kind of leads you to the Air Force. I did also want to be a shuttle pilot until pretty well into my Air Force career to be an astronaut. Difficult, as people might think, because when the shuttle program was around, you had to basically own fighter pilots, therefore Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps people are eligible. All right. So that drastically narrows the field. But even with that, I was more drawn to intel overall and got into the Air Force. And from intel school at the time, it was 9 months, which was for Air Force officers. And that was the second longest behind pilot training in terms of technical training to be an intelligence officer. So I loved it. And I remember thinking, I can't believe I'm being paid to learn how to steal secrets. And basically, that's one way to look at intel. The government is paying you to legally steal secrets from adversaries and so forth. And so I've always liked it, liked the process. And yeah, the rest is history.
I think that if I could ever pick my dream job after watching James Bond and seeing all these really cool CIA movies and stuff, that's what I always wanted to do. I never got the opportunity to do it. I was stuck on the beat working as a beat cop, but it sounds like just an amazing and
interesting career. Now, you've held roles where bad calls can have serious consequences. How do you learn to make decisions under that kind of pressure? And what did you get wrong early on?
Oh, wow. Tough question. When you get commissioned as an officer in any service, one thing you learn is that the main difference, people think it's education, right? And the difference between officer and enlisted, it's not. I knew enlisted folks who had master's degrees and even doctorates. The big difference is the responsibility, right? Officers are ultimately responsible. So that can lead to some stress, some high pressure situations, especially when you do. One of my specialities was target intelligence, and it could be very consequential. And so if you recommend the wrong targets or provide the wrong coordinates, a pilot might bomb a hospital or a school, and then that's on you, right? That's not all the pilot's doing. Is he or she is basing that decision on the coordinates and the information you gave him or her. And so that can lead to some stressful situations. And so it all comes down to professionalism and leadership and mentoring your team and so forth. And yeah, in terms of mistakes, so I like many leaders, I've made mistakes in terms of leadership, and then you just learn to grow from them.
What surprised you most working in intelligence? I know you said you always had a tertiary passion for it, but when you actually got in the chair, you're pulling this intelligence in, what was the thing that surprised you most about what you got yourself into versus what we all see on TV in the movies?
Sure. Wow. A couple things. One is a lot of it is just bean counting, right? It's sitting behind the desk and just doing work. And so there's a lot of, you look at the James Bond movies, Mission Impossible stuff, very little, almost none of it is anything close to that. And then, because you have the different ints, what they call ints, the different types of intelligence. And so only one part of intelligence work is the case officer, the human intelligence part, right? And even then, it's rarely ever as sexy as what you see in the James Bond movies. A lot of it is just sitting at the desk doing the work or interviewing people. And so even the James Bond types who are out, the case officers, doing the hard work of building relationships over weeks, months, years, that intelligence that they get, they're sending that back to the analyst. And the analyst, who are usually sitting behind the desk, they're doing that work. So that was one enlightening thing when I first got into, wow, a lot of it is like just a lot of bean counting. So in the military, it's all about a lot of the work is on what's called order of battle, right? If you might potentially go to war against a country, you need to know how many tanks they have at which location, and how many aircraft, how many personnel they have in X division or X or Y regiment. And that's something that the military is very good at, very good, if it's prioritized high enough. And then that's what I mean by bean counting. It's tedious work, but it's very necessary. And the military and intelligence community overall is very good at it. I think another thing that might surprise me is that, or that did surprise me, is the level of responsibility that intelligence personnel have, both at the enlisted level and officer level. For example, I had one assignment at the Pentagon and at Defense Intelligence Agency, and that was simultaneous, just the way that part of the military is structured. And it was interesting. You hear stories, if you're a captain or a major, you're making coffees for the general, if you're in Pentagon. And what I found, and this surprised me a few years into my career, is how much responsibilities that relatively junior folks in intelligence have, both within whether at the Pentagon or elsewhere, because it's not the colonels or the generals or if you're familiar with the government pay scale for civilians, the GS-15s, the senior executive service. Usually it's not those senior folks who are doing that, the bean counting, right? It's the people doing that analysis are relatively junior folks compared to the generals and the civilian senior executive service.
In law enforcement, we have a saying, right? 98% of the job is boredom and 2% is sheer terror, right? There's no mixed bag there. It's just a small percent that's going to jump right out at you. It must be so much more compounded in your line of work, right? You're talking about if the target's wrong, it hits a hospital, it hits a civilian center. How do you deal with that stress, right? And making those important decisions under pressure?
Yeah, you got to trust your team. You got to be competent, for one. Know your stuff. Know your team. Mentor your team. Practice. So you know, in the Air Operations Center, when we're deployed, we would practice time-sensitive targeting. This is where something pops up, whether it be, say, for example, an insurgent or terrorist, and it's unexpected. And we would have to work up the GPS coordinates very quickly, do collateral damage assessment. No other country in the world cares about collateral damage like the US and its closest allies, the Brits, the Aussies, Canadians, as an example. And in addition to working up these GPS coordinates, which is maybe it's changed now, but when I was doing it, it wasn't just clicking on a building. It's far more difficult than it might seem. And you got to wear 3D glasses with the latest imagery and so forth. And so literally 3D glasses. And also in addition to doing that, you got to do the collateral damage estimate, right? And so how many people you think might die or be injured. And it differs with whether it's day or night. And the military is very good at that. And so it would pretty accurate collateral damage estimates. And it's not a great term. It's almost too antiseptic, but it's very important to in our attempt to minimize collateral damage. And so you're doing all that, and you got to do that within minutes. And by the way, I make a recommendation on not only the type of weapon, but the few settings for each weapon, right, in terms of air-to-ground bombs. And so a lot of stress, just a few minutes to do all that and not screw it up. And so you got to really trust your team and practice and be competent.
Yeah, so a little odd question here. So my brother and I in the show, it seems like AI comes up a lot. In your experience, or do you think in the future, do you think intelligence agencies will rely on AI a lot to gather data, or have you in the past, or where's that kind of play into all of it?
When I was in, we didn't use it at all at the various levels where I work, but based on public comments, speeches by senior intel folks, I know it's being used now, and it's necessary to aid in intelligence collection and a certain level of analysis. It will never, ever, in my opinion, replace the human element, right? There are just some things you can't do with AI, and there are certain ways of thinking, context, and so forth. So I don't think we'll ever get to a point where AI will completely replace all aspects of.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Or even individual steps of the intelligence cycle collection, planning collection, and so forth. Overall, yeah, bottom line, it's a great tool, facilitates a lot, but I think a lot of folks are overconfident in what AI can bring to various sectors.
In my work, Casey, it's a great force multiplier, right? But we always intercede with human in the loop in order to make those informed decisions because they are game-changing decisions. Do you really think that AI should be playing a role within that space? Are those stakes just too high that you don't want a machine or a bot to make those determinations for you? Or do you feel it's safe to have it as a force multiplier? I'm sure a lot of this has been helped with the DOGE initiatives that are currently going on in the Trump administration. But do you think it's helpful and it's something we should be using? Or do you think it's a detractor and slowing you down?
It can and should definitely be used as a force multiplier or aid. But in terms of, say, one example, lethal decisions, right? It would almost be criminal to rely on AI to make life and death situations. I just don't see that, at least in many cases, if not most cases. But there is nothing wrong. We'd be remiss if we didn't use it to help cue other collection, point us to the right direction on some things. There's some things you don't really need a human in the loop for, and it just has to be done in the right way. And one example I like to use to show limits of AI, I know there are different levels of AI. I think in one of your podcasts, you talked about the different levels of AI. But I remember applying for one job once and uploaded my resume. And for some reason, this, and I don't know if it was AI, just an algorithm or a language learning model. But this thing basically said, yeah, at one point I worked in the Ukraine Ministry of Defense, right? Absolutely nothing in my background or on my resume says Ukraine, nothing at all. I've never worked a Ukraine issue when I was serving in government. So I have no idea where that came from, but that shows the limitations of AI. Yeah, it's great to use, but we need to have some level of realism and what we could do with it, and also have human in the loop at the right spots.
Yeah, so I know you do a lot of forecasting. So how about we take this time to talk about the end of 2025? And I think you said you forecasted out to the spring of 26.
Yeah, so one of the things I'm watching for the rest of 25 is the health of some senior folks and not so senior folks. I call it my department of gerontocracy. And yeah, so we got a lot of older folks in various countries at the senior level. So number one on my list is Donald Trump. And this will make some folks uncomfortable, but this is based on one, just having been a consumer of what I call biographic intel. It's not one of the official ints. It's one of the things you look at if we're looking at a country, say, Jay Atania, right? The president of one of these countries, you look for certain signals, certain indicators. Is that president's team obfuscating certain things, or has he or she gone missing for a while? And so you look at all these things and other indicators that in some cases very obvious, but because of certain of cognitive biases, we try to not think about it or overlook it. A lot of times this happens to intel analysts too, we ignore the obvious, right? And the same things I saw that happened with Trump's predecessor, Joe Biden, I'm seeing it with Trump and his team, right? The obfuscations, the bizarre explanation for things. And for example, no one in the White House mentioned the MRI that he took. We only know about that because Trump mentioned in what appeared to be a little bit of bragging about his cognitive abilities. He mentioned, oh, I took an MRI test, and folks in the press and political analysts were like, wait, what? And then the explanation a few days later, when he was asked what it was about, the explanation was very bizarre that he didn't know what it was. It wasn't for his head. So it's just weird that you didn't know what it was for. And by the way, it's not normal. MRIs are not normally used for preventative measure for patients. And for all these reasons, other indicators, I don't think Trump will be in office for days, for after the next few weeks or months. I think that his excellent medical care that he receives, just like with as all presidents to Joe Biden and all the presidents before him, I think that's one reason he's doing relatively well. But I don't see him sticking around for long in office. I don't know. I don't think he's going to die in the next few months, but I'm pretty confident that he will have to resign, or the 25th Amendment will be invoked in the next few months at the most. I'm also, for the rest of 2025, leading to 2026, I'm also looking at members of Congress. This is the third oldest Congress in right now. That might change a little come January, but right now it's the third oldest Congress in the history of the U.S. And we've had quite a few over the last several years, members of Congress die while they're in office. A couple were basically taken dementia medication, and one was officially serving while she was in a healthcare facility for dementia. I'm looking at members of Congress. It wouldn't surprise me sometime this month or next year that a member of Congress dies in office, like what has occurred in the past. And I should mention that for both Trump, the president, and members of Congress, that yields potentially continuity of government issues, at least at the presidential level. In Congress, that with a thin, and I don't get into politics, but it does result in potential issues with the minority-majority split in Congress, right? So it does have, it might have implications, especially on the House side. And by the way, just to go back to Trump, I think there are some mental and physical issues there, mental issues caused by some physical ailments. So it just speech patterns and so forth. Again, this is stuff that we'd look at if we're looking at another country. I'm looking at Putin also, but I don't think that's a near-term thing. Putin is rumored to have cancer. He's rumored to have body doubles, as many as eight, is what I've heard. a lot of people think, I don't have a strong opinion on this, but a lot of people think the person who showed up in Alaska is not the real Putin. There was one thing that did throw me off was his mannerisms when he was sitting down with Donald Trump on that stage. His either he drank a lot of coffee or it was not Putin, but just the mannerism, the joking around, that was not like Putin at all. So that caused me to raise an eyebrow. And there have been statements by the Biden's White House and then Senator Rubio, who pretty much imply that, yeah, there are some health issues with Putin. So when Senator who has access to classified information and White House implies health problems with a foreign leader, I take that seriously. And finally, with President Bio of Cameroon, oldest person, the whole oldest head of state, I think right now he's on my watch list for, if not 2025, 2026. Also, 2025, I'm looking at Russia, Ukraine. I have no idea how that's going to go because it all depends on how much support the U.S. provides and how much support the EU is able to pick up if the U.S. support, material intelligence support, drops, right? And for Thanksgiving, made a bet with a family member whether Russia or Ukraine will prevail. And our bets were low because it's just another family member was like, really, you're betting only $10? Yeah, I have no idea how that's going to go because my fear is Ukraine, it'll be hard for Ukraine to prevail if, assuming there's no peace treaty or permanent ceasefire, I think it'll be hard for Ukraine to prevail if U.S. support just dried up overnight. And that's something that I think the entire world is watching, especially for over the next few weeks.
Yeah, to get back to Trump a little bit, it's a two-part question, right? So we're talking about the cognitive decline of Trump. And what are the associated risks with that, right? Obviously, you're talking about invoking the 25th Amendment. If I remember my law, I should know it better. But I think that's when the vice president steps in and takes over power for him. But generally, before those handoffs occur, you usually see risk associated with it. There's a lot of people, I'm in this camp, but you're the expert, so you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but like we're very close to World War III. How close is it, right, with that cognitive decline and making incorrect decisions could lead us further or nudge us further towards World War III?
With cognitive decline, impulsiveness increases, right? Now, Trump, as with some leaders, is impulsive. I think much more so with Trump. That will just increase. So there is a risk there. And if anything, that might be why that's part of my analysis or reason for my analysis that the 25th will be invoked is I see a concern of the impulsiveness that comes with that, the cognitive decline. And I realize this conversation will make some people very uncomfortable, but I'm just looking at it from a geopolitical risk standpoint, trying to be unbiased as possible, that there is a risk. Now, I don't necessarily think World War III would be any closer to that because of these cognitive issues. But I think we could safely say that it could be safe to have a concern. It would be honest to have a concern that the impulsiveness could lead to decisions that someone else in that office, another person would not make. And I'm trying to be careful in not getting into politics, but yeah, when you combine the cognitive decline with the fact that the person in that office is basically the most powerful person in the world, leader of the free world, has access to all kinds of those most dangerous weapons that the world knows. There is a concern there. When you're looking at the military deployment to Venezuela and what could happen.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Russia, Ukraine. Yeah, there was a concern there.
So anything else in your end of 2025, mid 2026 forecast? Pandemics, potential viruses, anything else that you're forecasting?
Yeah, definitely. Infectious diseases, I'm watching that closely. Three of them, flu, measles, whooping cough. And so flu, right now in the U.S., it's somewhat stable, although in L.A. and Colorado, those CDC, the week before Thanksgiving, CDC listed Louisiana and I think I said LA, Louisiana and Colorado as high. And there is my concern is in December, but where in the US flu season peaks starts to rise and then it usually peaks January, February, and then a second peak in March. And last year, 280 kids died of flu, although about half of them had coexisting conditions. Almost all of them did not have vaccinations, right? And so these were maybe preventable deaths. And no deaths so far that we know of based on CDC data for this year yet. But as we finish out December, go into January, February, the pediatric deaths from flu, which again are usually preventable, is what I'm watching. And also in terms of flu, there's flu and there's bird flu, right? And one thing that the medical experts are fearing is that someone could get infected with both bird flu and the seasonal flu, and then that leads to a new strain of what's called resortment that can lead to an epidemic or even pandemic. That's something to watch for. And by the way, UK, Japan, Hong Kong already seeing an early start to flu season. So that's kind of a concern in addition to a new variant of H3N2 of the flu. Now, in terms of measles, we're not doing well. This is a disease that should be eradicated everywhere in the world, but because of vaccine hesitancy, it's not. And this year, we're seeing the most measles cases in 30 years, right? Not good. So as of a couple of days ago, CDC listed over 1,800 confirmed measles cases in 43 states. And so specifically, the highest cases were in Texas, over 800, Arizona, about 150, and then followed by Utah, New Mexico, Kansas, South Carolina. So we're seeing lots of measles cases there. And when I look at that and I combine that with the measles vaccine coverage for kindergartners, right? Those kids are very vulnerable. And basically you want the vaccination rates of, I think, 95, 96%. And you have quite a few states where it's less than 90%. And as a risk manager, risk guy, I'm looking at those states that have a very low vaccination rate. And whooping cough, that's an issue right now in Kentucky. And in fact, I think we had a third child die in Kentucky a few weeks ago. And so those are three infectious diseases I'm very concerned about for the rest of December and into next year.
How about COVID? What's your outlook on COVID and coming into the winter season?
It doesn't concern me too much yet because based on the data that we have from CDC, it doesn't look to be an issue right now, but that can change. There's some delay reporting because of the U.S. government shutdown. But right now, surprisingly, it's not an issue, but that could change. And by the way, once the data, a lot of people travel for Thanksgiving. And so the next week or two, we'll see what all that traveling over Thanksgiving, how that affected COVID and other diseases like the flu and measles.
Since we're talking about your forecast, I think back in 2022, you forecasted, maybe I got the year wrong, but back in 2022, you forecasted a potential political assassination. And obviously we all know what happened with Donald Trump. Maybe it's 2024. I got my dates all messed up. It's been a long day.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it was 2022. I did my forecast. I forecasted that there would be an assassination attempt against a nationally elected figure. And it turns out that a couple years later, there was, of course, the Butler assassination attempt against Trump and Butler on the campaign train. And then there's another, I guess it's technically an attempt, but no shots were fired, but the guy hiding in the woods at his golf course. And yeah, and I should mention that, and this is the same with the other forecast, for example, the Trump health issue and members of Congress. Intel isn't prediction, right? Intelligence is not prediction work, it's forecast. So it's providing a list of possibilities, right? And so some of these things might turn out to never occur. That would be great. But yeah, the reason why I made that forecast was a few things. We're the most polarized that we have been since the 1800s, right, in the US and in some other countries too. And also there's social media has a lot to play. So there's some research that says that the more people are online, the more, you know, the more radicalized they get in the real world. And so you have a few variables that make the perfect storm that can lead to political violence. So unfortunately, in my forecast, was right on the money, even if it took a couple of years. I see that continuing to be a problem, actually, for 2026.
Yeah, some people listening may be like, those are really big events, and they're not going to happen to me. And if it do happen, it's not going to really matter. A lot of young fathers, and I'm a young father myself, listen to this show. What would you tell them to prepare for in the next month or perhaps first part of the year? What to be in tune for? What to watch for so that you can keep your family safe and protected in the coming months?
Yeah, sure. It's important to live your lives. And so there's a, I forgot his name, but there's a retired lieutenant colonel, I think his name is Cooper, and he had the different, it's almost like a stoplight system, right? Where if you're in the safety of your residence, you know, you're at green level, right? There's no need to be concerned about. Of course, it's different if you're in an unfortunate situation like domestic intimate partner violence, right? But be outside of that, if you're in a safe place like your residence, dependent on a few things. You could be at green level. At the other extreme is red, where something has happened. You hear gunshots and you're pretty sure they're not your, say, a political event, and you're pretty sure they're not balloons or firecrackers or car backfiring. And by the way, a car usually doesn't backfire more than once, right? In any given, in a short period of time, then you're at red, right? And in between, so in many situations out in public, political rally, shopping, holiday shopping, you might want to be at yellow, where you're not stressing yourself out because no one could stay for more than a few minutes at yellow, at orange, right, or red. You want to stay at that yellow level where you're alert and aware. You go into a restaurant, you instinctively look for where the exit is, right? And that's it. Then you enjoy your meal and not worry about too much. Overall, you have kids, nieces, nephews, other family members. You want to encourage people to just live their lives, just but at the appropriate time or when you see indicators, don't be in denial and go to that next level of alertness and be prepared to act.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I think a lot about it when I take my kids out to like the Christmas markets or movie theaters or what have you, because I always in the back of my mind, we see a lot of that domestic terrorism that's going on in the United States now. And so those are always my fears. So I always like to take that father's lens, right? Because I have young children. My brother has children as well. And it's just good to be prepared. But turning the page now, right? Sure. Back towards Trump. You've obviously followed Iran very closely. What are your thoughts on Trump's claim to have obliterated Iran's nuclear program?
I see politicians and pundits make this mistake all the time. There's a difference between destroying or eliminating or obliterating a program versus facilities. The U.S. military and several countries in the world, Israel, some of the most powerful militaries can easily destroy many facilities, even some underground bunkers, not all, but some underground bunkers if they're not too deep or too fortified. That's easy, but destroying a program is almost always impossible. It's always impossible unless you launch a full-scale invasion. Why is that? A program consists of many things, and people tend to focus on just the facilities, right? There's a lot of hype around, especially in the news media, about the bunkers, Iran's bunkers, and even like North Korean bunkers. But a program, that's only one of many aspects of a program, any kind of WMD program, nuclear program. And so you have the scientists, you got the researchers, you got the electronic files, you have the hard files, right? And so, for example, the importance of these files, there's a famous case where Israel admitted to basically in one of a stunning intel success where they went into a Iran and I guess the Mossad and stole a bunch of nuclear files, right? Which is just a stunning intel success. That shows you the importance of files when you're doing any kind of research. It was during the Manhattan Project in the US and is for anyone trying to start a nuclear program. You got electronic systems, right? I'm sorry, electronic files. You could go on the web and purchase hard drive or solid state drive that contains terabytes of data. That's the size of one or two phones, right? Smartphones. A program can't be destroyed if even one or two of those solid state drives or hard drives exist somewhere in the country. Good luck finding that. when you can hide it in anyone's pocket, a garage, a table, a car, driving away from Tehran. And that this is why it's hard to, it's almost impossible to destroy a program. And so that's why I remember a few years ago, former Secretary of Defense Gates had mentioned a couple times in public, once in front of in congressional testimony, that the most the U.S. could set back Iran is 2 or 3 years with a strike on its nuclear facilities. And that's why.
When you say purchasing of like the solid state drives or essentially the information, right? Are we talking about nuclear program information of how to like how they created the nuclears? Is that a risk?
Yeah.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Just the design information, there are basically two overall types of weapons. You got implosion-type weapons, and then you got the gun-type weapon, right? And an implosion type nuclear weapon, you got the uranium pit and you got the explosives that go around it to condense the uranium pit to make that critical mass, right? The fissionable critical mass. So that's a lot of design work and a lot of research. Yeah, a scientist could keep that in his or her head, but to do that coordination and facilitate that collaboration coordination, yeah, you need to store this information in somewhere. And so that information is going to be either stored on print in hard files, printed files or drawings, whatever, or on some kind of electronic system. And by the way, one other thing too, and the Iranians admitted to this reportedly, is that they move a lot of their enriched uranium outside of the three facilities, underground facilities that the U.S. bombed, right? And to secret locations. And that's always been a problem with WMD programs. You don't know about the programs, the facilities that you don't know about, right? And so that's another reason why it's hard to obliterate or destroy or eliminate a WMD program to include nuclear programs. There might be sites that you don't know about, which is where you could keep things like enriched uranium or files and various components, like say a nuclear warhead, right? A nuclear warhead is not that big. You could keep that in any garage. And when you hear things, certain verbs, descriptions that are absolutist, obliterate, destroy, eliminate, it's almost impossible for any military in the world to do those. Yeah. So that's one tip to all the pundits and politicians out there. So things like when you hear terms like destroy Hamas or destroy Hezbollah, good luck with that, because that means you are killing, you'd have to kill pretty much every single Hamas or Hezbollah person. It's easy to degrade these groups, but when you're talking about obliterating or eliminating, yeah, that's whether it's a terrorist group or a WMD program, much more difficult.
When we were talking in our pre-show, you said you had worked in the Mideast and North Korea, those regions for intelligence. What concerns you most about Iran? Is it the WMDs or is it the financing of terrorism and the offshoot terrorist groups that are proxies for them?
The Iranian proxies and their terrorist reach, that concerns me far more than any nuclear program. As late as early this year, the U.S. intelligence community concluded that U.S. was not pursuing a nuclear weapons program. I assume that's possibly changed now because of that U.S. strike, which is a U.S. and Israeli attack on its nuclear facilities. But up to early this year, that was not the case. It's always been the proxies that concern me most. So I'll give you one example. Hezbollah is funded by Iran, according to, I think it was a State Department document during the first Trump administration, mentioned that at one point Iran provided over $700 million in 1 year to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is really one of the only terrorist groups in the world that scare me. Al-Qaeda has never scared, even after 9/11, Al-Qaeda didn't really scare me that much. Believe it or not, it was always Hezbollah. And those of us who've worked terrorism issue, it's always been Hezbollah that has scared us. And so you look at the U.S., over 100 Hezbollah-related folks have been arrested in the U.S. over the last couple few decades. And I assume Hezbollah is here in the U.S. and Hezbollah just needs to flip a switch to activate them. And also Iran has shown a tendency to try to do things in the U.S. One of my forecasts back in 2022 was Iran will continue to avenge the death of General Soleimani, who was one of its most senior military generals, the head of the Quds force in Iran, which is basically, for those not familiar with it, is basically if you were to take the CIA, Joint Special Operations Command, Defense Intelligence Agency, put them all into one, that's the Quds force. And so the Quds force is arguably indirectly responsible for more deaths than Al-Qaeda, more American blood spilled than Al-Qaeda, at least prior to 9/11. And that's another reason why Iran's reach with its proxies has always concerned me more.
Obviously, we've dropped some massive bombs on their facilities. Israel's been at war with them for quite a bit now, bombing their facilities, attacking the Hezbollah offshoots. Has anything changed? Has our risk landscape changed? Is there still a risk to the United States and Israel based upon the actions that are occurring in region? Or do we just delay the inevitable? Like, we'll be talking about the same thing in a couple of years.
All the above. And so I think things are relatively stable now. But again, because if you believe Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense Gates, and this was supposedly Defense Intelligence Agency's conclusion after the U.S. followed up the Israeli strikes with the strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, we only set the program back a few months, right? And yeah, so at some point, either Israel and the U.S. will either have to reattack or just accept that we only set the program back a few months or maybe 2 or 3 years. But the situation is very stable now. I shouldn't say very stable, is relatively stable. My concern is if there's another re-attack on Iran for the exact reasons I mentioned, that we've only set the program back months or maybe a year or two. And so I think that Iran might not be as restrained as it was during the attack this summer, right, on its nuclear facilities. Iranian decision-making is very deliberate, very careful. And so what we saw with Iran is retaliation, but it was done. They escalated to de-escalate, right? They made sure not to go too far because they feared, and some Iranian insiders actually said this publicly, they didn't want the wrath of the U.S., right? If it responded too harshly against Israel and Iran. If there is another attack by Israel and or the U.S., I fear that Iran might let loose a lot more, and then it will be a very terrible situation for Israel and maybe U.S. interests, U.S. bases in Middle East and the region overall.
So in terms of Hezbollah and some of these proxy groups, what do you think the likelihood of actual Hezbollah or other terrorist organizations being in this country waiting to be activated? I've heard some analysts say that it exists. I know our borders have been fairly porous the past, maybe not this year, but the 4 years prior. It seems like a logical conclusion you can make that there could be a significant amount of terrorists waiting to be activated. Do you see that as a potential?
It's a potential, but I think it's low probability, and here's why. Hezbollah, even though it gets maybe most of its funding from Iran, that's not debatable. It is a proxy of Iran. And Hezbollah has killed, again, prior to 9/11, killed more Americans than Al-Qaeda did prior to 9/11. It would have to take Iran directing Hezbollah, activate your stuff, launch attacks against not only Israel, but U.S. interests, and then in turn agreeing to that and carrying out Iranian orders. And I think low probability of that. It's one of those low probability, high impact things. And for example, that did not happen after the U.S. attacked the Iranian homeland for the first time in history, right? When it attacked the three nuclear sites, Hezbollah operatives weren't activated in the U.S. And so low probability, but high impact.
So you do think there's a probability that some could be here?
Yes, not only here, but around the world. And that's one of the, if you look at, okay, the cost versus benefits of attacking Iran, you got to look at that. One of the worst terrorist attacks in Latin America were back in the 90s when Iran, I think it was Argentina twice. Once was a Jewish community center in Argentina, right? And usually it's not just Iran uses proxies, right? And there have been many assassination attempts around the world, especially in Europe. And so the Iranian, the government calls it the Iranian Threat Network, basically has reach all over the world. The only limitation is one, Iranian decision making, because Iran's not going to do something that jeopardizes the regime, the existence of the regime. That's the regime's, the theocracy's primary reason. Primary goal is regime survival, right? Two is the capability and reach, capability and capacity to launch these attacks. And what we've seen, thankfully, is a lot of the incompetence by the Iranian threat network, especially Iranians. If you look at some of the thwarted attempts in various countries, in one case, an Iranian operative blew himself up, blew his legs off in a failed bombing attempt, right, as a few years ago. And there, thankfully, there's the Iran threat network is not a bunch of James Bond folks, Jason Bourne, James Bond folks who are just incapable of everything. But that is a concern. And so when you're looking at, when politicians are looking at the calculus of, okay, do we hit Iran for X? What are the repercussions both within the region, around the world, and within the U.S. homeland? But yeah, it is a possibility.
When other countries, like other countries in the Middle East, see that the United States takes action, specifically against Iran when they drop the bombs, does that embolden terrorism? Right. Like, is there a counter effect to that? Like, I remember seeing like the people on TV, like, down with America and burning the American flags, right? Is that almost counterproductive when we do these kind of small scale attacks, right? We're just bombing a couple of facilities. Does that increase the hate and then increase our risk?
It does. And so that's where the cost benefit comes in, right? And the Iranian, based on comments from supposed Iranian insiders, they're basically like, yeah, you attacked our homeland, but you hit, the U.S. hit only three of its sites. And by the way, according to these same Iranian insiders, they said that, they claimed that, yeah, we moved the enriched stuff elsewhere anyway. And limited strikes have far less possibility of creating more terror.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
But when you're destroying, when you don't care about that much about collateral damage, when you're injuring or killing family members, right, that happened in Afghanistan, happened in Iraq, you're creating more terrorists. And so you got to be very careful and look at your goals, especially when you realize that, again, the militaries usually can't achieve absolute terms, destroy and eliminate, right? So if you're trying to destroy and eliminate a terrorist group, not only is it impossible to achieve that impossible goal, you got to do some pretty unsavory things, either by choice or by accident. And those unsavory things include a lot of collateral damage. And just like any one of us, if some country were to invade the U.S. and kill our family members, now we're in the fight, right? If a terrorist group were to kill, or some nation state were to kill our kids or niece or nephew, we're in the fight. And so that's one of the downsides. And you got to weigh the cost, benefit, and losses. And by the way, counterterrorism, fighting terrorism with only counterterrorism never, ever works. And that's one of the reasons why. You got to address the underlying cause of that terrorism, or else you'll be fighting terrorism forever.
First statement. What concerns you the most about terrorism today, whether it's in the U.S. or globally? But what's the biggest risk that we're facing?
Exactly what I just said. The biggest risk is fighting terrorism with only counterterrorism. It never works. It's like playing whack-a-mole. And so I think that's the biggest risk. Within the U.S., domestic terrorism has always been there. We could go back to the 90s with the Oklahoma City bombing, and we live in a very polarized world now, and there are different waves of terrorism. Right now, and this might, I know people will get upset about this, but right now, based on the last 20 years, 20, 30 years, the most of the attacks have been right-wing, terrorists that have been right-wing in the U.S., but it's not a partisan thing. That's just what the data shows. In the 70s and 80s, most of the terrorist attacks in the U.S. were left-wing, right? The first attack by U.S. citizens on the U.S. Capitol was the U.S.'s only female terrorist group. It was a bomb, and they bombed the U.S. Capitol. Lots of damage. And a lot of people say, oh, wow, the U.S. had all-female terrorist group? Yeah, wow. They bombed the U.S. Capitol. A left-wing group. And what needs to happen is, and one of my concerns is, as we look at a lot of things we do in terms of fighting terrorism, is not intelligence-based, at least in the U.S. And so you got to have a very sober analysis of the issue and who's involved and what it will take to fight it. This year, going into next year, the next wave might be all left-wing groups fighting this administration policies. We don't know, but regardless of where you stand politically, you have to look at the causes and results of terrorism with an unbiased eye, or else you'll keep making the same mistakes. And I think that, unfortunately, that's what has happened over the last decade or two.
So I understand you had a pretty heavy hand in helping with the no-fly list. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, just one extremely small aspect of it. So yeah, my last job in the military, we had established a relationship in our unit with the Customs and Border Protection, the back end folks, the intel and the pretty much the intel side of it. And one of the most capable operations I've ever seen. Again, this is not the part that most people see when you go to a port of entry at the airport, but the back end side of it. Wow, what an impressive intel operation. And so we established this relationship, and I won't bore you with the details, but it turns out that a lot of information from the military and other areas weren't getting to Customs and Border Protection. Part of me being innovative and having a lot of initiative. And so that resulted in a bunch of folks being put on the no-fly list that weren't on the no-fly list. But people who we knew or suspected were terrorists. And other, they're like various watch lists and no-fly lists. But yeah, one of the most interesting was General Soleimani, and I'm sure I mispronounced his name, but he was, again, the guy who was assassinated in the first Trump administration. He was the Quds Force commander, one of the most important figures in Iran. So much so that there are some rumors in Iran that he might run for political office someday when he retires from the military before he was killed by the U.S. And it turns out that shared our prioritized list with, that's one of the innovative things I did, was came up with our prioritized list of terrorists for our organization, share that with Customs Border Protection. Turns out that Soleimani, he's on the list, but his biometrics were not, just an oversight. And so he could have put on a disguise and scanned his fingerprint at a port of entry, and no one would have known the better, right? If the background document, he would have gotten into the U.S. Now, that's highly unlikely. Usually, you don't get someone at Soleimani's level to try to play like James Bond trying to get into the U.S., but still, it shows you the benefits of coordination, collaboration. And after a couple of days, the response I got was, wow, dude, thanks. his biometrics are now in the system.
In the pre-show, you said you spent 5 years gathering North Korean intelligence. Is there anything worth noting there, worth sharing, that you obviously can share without you getting yourself into trouble?
So I worked Northeast Asia, and overall, I did spend 5 years, cumulative years, a couple different assignments while working North Korean issues. One thing I'm constantly looking at is Kim Jong-un's health. One thing that my company looked at was we basically did a red team model after the CIA's red team memos. We did a red team document on his health. And I don't know how this guy is still alive. I really don't know. If both the lifestyle and genetic reasons, right? And so genetically, his family history is just ridiculously bad, right? From his grandfather, his father, his aunts, uncles, his half-brother. I'll give you one example, a couple examples. In terms of heart disease, your half-sibling is more of a risk factor than your parents, right? Believe it or not. And this is based on medical research. And so his half-brother was known to have, his half-brother, Kim Jong-un, the current leader of North Korea, assassinated in a famous attack in, I think it was Malaysia, using a chemical weapon or a biological weapon. I forget which one it was. I think it was VX. And he killed his half-brother, but his half-brother was known to have heart problems. And that's based on a Western doctor who treated his brother. And again, half-sibling heart problems are more of a risk factor than your parents' heart problems. And that's just one example. And so his father and Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather had heart problems with stress when you're running a dictatorship, when most population is starving from famine, people might want to kill you. So that stresses you out. You got the U.S. and South Korea not liking what you're doing. I guess that stresses people out. And so you got not only genetics working against Kim Jong-un, but you got lifestyle problems too. In addition to stress, he smokes, he drinks a lot, based on folks like Dennis Rodman, folks who've visited him, other diplomats who've been in North Korea, and he's gone missing for a while. I'll be surprised if he, and then there's a weight problem also that's very obvious that everyone can see. And yeah, that's one of the many things I'm watching with North Korea is health. If he were to die, who would take over? North Korea is a patriarchal society. It looks like he's trying to groom his daughter to take over from him. She's very young. So would there be a committee or regency that would like hold power for or groom his daughter or whoever if he were to die? Was his sister take over? There are all these questions related to North Korea. And there, of course, there's a nuclear program too. North Korea is probably one of the most interesting countries to watch and will be for 2026.
I think there's a couple countries that we think about. At least when I lay down at night, I usually think about Iran because of our recent military activity there. And then North Korea is one of those. And as you said, Kim Jong-un, you can look at a picture of him. It looks like this guy's never skipped a meal in his entire life. And even though he's torturing his citizens, he's enslaving his people, he's really just running his own people into the ground. Is it a net benefit if he does die of a heart attack? What would that kind of look like in current state? Obviously, his daughter, I think, is 12 or very young. She can't run the empire. Is there any way that if, like, you cut off, sometimes they say you cut off the head of a snake and you produce 12 more, but is it a better world? Right. Is there a path to democracy or some type of freedom if the Kim Jong line gets out of the way?
It's hard to tell, possibly. And here's why. There's a chance that, say, his sister were to take over or temporarily take over. There's a chance that she might be less authoritarian and less brutal than Kim Jong-un. Remember that Kim Jong-un reportedly murdered his uncle, who helped groom him after murdered his uncle, was supposedly with an anti-aircraft battery, right? Again, don't know if that's ever been concerned, but either way, he murdered his uncle. And so would his sister be less brutal and more open to not being as belligerent with the West and with South Korea? I don't know. It could go either way. There's a chance that she might be worse than him, than Kim Jong-un. So it's one of those things, like, flip a coin. It could go either way. There's a lot of times in international affairs, geopolitics, there's the unintended consequences. The example of Iraq, right? So Iraq, Saddam Hussein was one of the most murderous dictators in the world and used chemical weapons against his own people. But he also hated Al-Qaeda. And there's a story, I don't know how true it is, but I think it's true, where he murdered one or two Al-Qaeda folks who were traveling through Iraq, right? Iraq under Saddam was also counterpoint to Iran, right? They're like mortal enemies, Iraq and Iran. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, that eliminated Iraq as a foil to Iran. And so Iraq now is basically a vassal state is probably too strong of a word, but basically Iraq is now in Iran's camp, right? And during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, it became basically breeding ground for terrorism. The ISIS or Islamic State got its start in Iraq during the U.S. occupation years. And so you could use the example of Iraq to see how, wow, it might not be obvious right then, but the law of unintended consequences was huge in Iraq. And that might be the case in North Korea if Kim Jong-un were to fall or were to die.
Yeah, I just see North Korea as like a proxy state for China. I could be wrong. I'm not the expert you are, but I feel like regardless of who's in charge in North Korea, I really feel like to a vast extent, China's kind of pulling those strings. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Maybe pulling strings is a little bit too strong of a term, but it does seem like China has a lot of influence over North Korea. And one reason is a lot of it is just most of it, if not all of it, is self-interest, because if war were to break out between North Korea and South Korea or Kim Jong-un were to fall, there could be a massive influx of migrants flowing into China. China doesn't want that. And so a lot of it is China's self-interest to maybe keep North Korea in its orbit and try to make sure that doesn't happen. Also concerning is North Korea's support for Russia in terms of personnel. I think it's about 10,000 people troops that North Korea provided to Russia, and also some equipment, also artillery shells and so forth. And yeah, you got that regional piece with China, but you also have North Korea having an influence, however little, on the Ukraine-Russia conflict.
It's a scary situation. I don't understand it. But to get back to one of your points, like when you were talking about Iraq and Iran, even though it was Iraq and Saddam Hussein were horrible people and it was a bad empire, there was some net benefit, right? Like it prevented a lot of the creation of the terrorism and the downfall. They were mortal enemies or between Iraq and Iran. Is there a net benefit with North Korea being the way it worked today?
Yeah, in terms of U.S. interest and its allies' interest, no. And the reason why I narrowed it to just U.S. and its allies, for China there is, because tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of North Koreans are not trying to flow into China, which is right on its border, to avoid whatever nasty situation, right? That could go away if there's a war or all of a sudden the border, North Korean border troops just melt away. It could be bad. But for regional stability, South Korea, there are all these reasons why, you know. And so remember, every once in a while, it hasn't happened in a while, but remember, North Korea has launched attacks and assassinations against South Korea. I think it's been a while since it happened, but remember that there's some senior folks who have been assassinated by North Korea, as an example. A few years ago, there's that sinking, North Korea sank that boat, South Korean boat, using one of the submarines. And yeah, it's North Korea, you can see why it's the bane. It's the current North Korea under this dictatorial dynasty is the bane of every U.S. president. And by the way, so if you look at Japan, I just received cruise missiles, Tomahawk cruise missiles from the U.S., right? A long time ago when I served in Japan as an intelligence officer, I Japanese air self defense officers told me that, yeah, we're tired of this North Korea situation and we want to be able to strike North Korea. And that's bearing fruit now many years later with the unprecedented acquisition of Tomahawk missiles by Japan to deal with situations like North Korea. This North Korean regime is not a good deal for anyone. And commercially too, there are some risks there. Look at Sony, the Sony hack by North Korea a few years ago because of that movie that came out. And a lot of embarrassing emails by Sony executive were hacked.
I don't know if you can answer this question, so I'll preface it with that. North Korea obviously says they have a nuclear bomb. There has been no shown proof. There's some people in the United States that says they don't. Is there a nuclear risk connected with North Korea today?
There is, but I think and this is just my opinion, it's going to be very controversial. I think for some reason with North Korea and to some extent Iran, maybe, we tend to throw out 70, 80 years of nuclear deterrence theory and reality when it comes to North Korea. And North Korea knows that the U.S. could level that country within minutes. Iran knows that Israel could level Iran within minutes with nuclear weapons. And so North Korea, of course, it would be great if none of these anti-West belligerent countries, dictatorships, have nuclear weapons, right? That would be ideal. But this is counterintuitive, but North Korean nuclear weapons don't worry me that much. It's the other stuff. It's the cyber capabilities, in my opinion, based on my experience. North Korea is the third best adversarial cyber capability in the world after Russia and China. It's North Korea. The Sony hack is an example. And they're always hacking South Korea, other countries, in terms of stealing stuff from banks, stealing money from banks and so forth. So in addition to the cyber capabilities, it's the covert capabilities, the assassination capabilities. the North Korean intel capability, well, focus on special ops. Their special ops are one of the most capable in the entire world. Right. I guess when you're spending all your money in the military and especially special ops, that tends to happen. But and these are not these are what if you look at the top folks at the U.S. now can talk about, as mentioned publicly, the Navy SEAL type, the Delta Force type, very small, capable units. You got entire regiments. You got huge units that are basically the North Korean equivalent of that, that could do a lot of damage in North Korea, in South Korea and other countries in the region. And the artillery, the estimates, I've seen public estimates, publicly disclosed estimates that 20 to 30,000 South Koreans could die within the first 24 hours or less of artillery assault on South Korea, right? And I think that's more of a concern than nuclear stuff, because I don't think the North Korea would use WMD, especially nukes, unless the regime was threatened, just like Iran. Same thing there. And so the threshold below that, that's vast. So when you talk about the cyber capabilities, the special ops and other covert capabilities, the intel capabilities, the artillery capabilities, for the and of course the missiles, right? So that's why Japan now has been seeking strike capabilities against North Korea, because of the missile capabilities, and so that North Korea has, and so for all these reasons, that's why I'm less concerned about the nuclear issue than many people.
A lot of people cite that we're supposedly building the Golden Dome over the United States to protect against nuclear threats, to protect against ballistic missiles that are coming from or these adversarial countries. Do you think that's true, or do you think our deterrence is good enough and perhaps it's a vanity thing, just saying we have better protection? Or why do you think the United States is reaching in that direction? Because obviously it's a huge project. We're not talking about Israel where we put the dome over the country and it's small and it's relatively capable. We're talking huge landmass to protect from this. Is there a risk out there that we should be worried about with North Korea or Iran or Russia or China or somebody that we should be thinking about that this is what this country needs today?
Yeah, the threat's there with China and North Korea. It obviously is. The threat's there. But the whole Golden Dome thing, which is pretty much a continuation of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars thing, there's a lot to unpack there, and none of it's good, right? And it's largely a vanity thing. The Golden Dome thing, or whatever it's being called, it's a play on the Israeli Golden Dome. It's a lot different. It's not going to be anywhere as capable. And here's why. Israel's Golden Dome it's limited. Israel is not such a huge country. And most importantly, Israel is not too concerned about ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, right? Iran does not need to fire ICBM long range, basically missiles that go to outer space and re-enter the atmosphere with all kinds of what's called MIRVs, multiple reentry vehicles, many of which are decoys, right? The Golden Dome doesn't have to deal with that. What's been proposed since Ronald Reagan's years is much more complicated. It's like hitting a bullet with a bullet. It's almost an impossibility. The few tests that have been done have been highly scripted, where it's almost like giving the student the answer to the test, right? And so not only do you have to attack a much faster bullet, ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, that's either in the mid-phase in space or re-entering the atmosphere, you have to differentiate between which ones are MIRVs, which ones are the decoys, right? And you have to do that within seconds. And I think, of course, politically, everyone wants to be for a protection system. The reality behind it, once you start peeling the onion back, is it's extremely limited, and it's been, in terms of bang for the buck, it's just not there. It's not a great success story.
So Casey, I know you do a lot with business continuity and personal protection. What are some things that corporations can do to help mitigate that risk, to forecast potential problems? What would you suggest to them?
Yeah, I think that this is something that some organizations do well, others not so well.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries.
Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Well, I think organizations need to pay attention to geopolitical risk a lot more. So it's becoming more popular or more prevalent. But I know some organizations have gotten rid of their geopolitical risk person or team, which I think is a bad idea. One organization that does it well, seems to do it well, I know I've read that 3M, way before other companies did, were able to notice that something was going on in terms of some kind of virus in China and elsewhere. And so they were, 3M was on it, other companies not so much. And you got to, especially for the global organizations, whether you're NGO, whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit organization, you got to take geopolitical risk seriously and do red team and scenario development and not think about things that, not think about only things that have happened exactly like they happened. I wrote an article a few years ago about red team and where I highlight several things, seven or eight indicators of, or just events that happened in the two decades prior to COVID, right? Various outbreak, MERS, SARS, Ebola, the publication of a pandemic. It was focused on flu pandemic, but the US government had published a pamphlet, a guide that talked about the exact same things that we ended up doing in 2020, 2021. They published this like 10 years before. And all the indicators, so when CEOs and other corporate leaders talk about, they claim that COVID was a black swan event, no one could have seen that company. No, that's not the case. Disaster prep folks were talking about the exact same type of scenario decades before. They're the events I talked about, MERS and SARS and so forth, that were basically almost a blueprint for what could happen. And so for this year with the stuff, the rest of this year, for the infectious diseases I talked about, for next year, the conflicts that's happening, that are happening around the world, again, the most conflicts in decades around the world, organizations need to think outside the box, do some red team and scenario analysis, take geopolitical risk seriously, especially when it comes to supply chains, and they'll be much better off.
You keep saying the term red team. Could you explain to our audience what
Sure.
that means?
So red team is basically just an alternative way of thinking, right? That's one of the different types of red team. The other is physically trying to break into stuff, whether it be cyber or physically, right? You can hire someone to test the what's that movie from the 90s? I think it's called Sneakers, where they would be hired to to break into, I remember Sidney Poitier was in there, they would hire this team to try to break into banks, whatever, right? That's one type of red team. And then the other is just a tabletop exercise. NYPD is really good. New York Police Department is really good at this, just tabletop exercises on what could go wrong at various events. And then the third type is the stuff I've done is the alternative way of thinking, just thinking about things that you normally would not think about. For example, I posit that if companies had red team, what could go wrong based on the previous outbreaks, they probably could have had things in place that could have helped them deal with COVID, like having people work from home, or companies or organizations, to include some government agencies, were trying to figure out how to have people work from home with the VPN and stuff like that. That could have been easily practiced years before COVID. So red team is just a different way to think about things.
Yeah, I actually work in risk management for about the past decade after I left law enforcement. And I was part of standing up a red team for Amazon Web Services, where our thing was social engineering, trying to get past the guard shacks, trying to break into facilities, trying to hack technical equipment to compromise, obviously compromise in a loose term, customer data. So you learn how to defend against it. But what you learn a lot of the times when you're doing those types of activity, whether it be red teaming or just doing risk analysis, a lot of times the CEOs and some of the executive leadership team don't understand the net benefit of why they should prioritize this for their organizations. So what would you say to those types of people, right? Yeah, that sounds scary. I don't really care. I'm still going to sell my product overseas, whether they have Ebola in that region or not. What would you say is the reason that they really should be prioritizing this stuff and taking it seriously and prepare?
Yeah, basically organizations need to lose the ego, right? And so I remember I've had a couple NSA assignments, and in one assignment, the head of comms, full colonel, he said, hey, red team the hell out of me. NSA has a red team outfit. And so we requested them for this, for the comms. And we were so impressed with this guy. He was a Navy captain or colonel equivalent in the other service. And we were so impressed with this guy because he didn't care about his ego. He said, hey, look, I want you to red team the heck out of me, find what's wrong with our communications, with our IT systems. And so you got to lose the ego and realize that it can only benefit you to find the stuff before the bad guys do. If you look at the pipeline incident from back from a couple of years ago, you look at all the outages that we've had recently that's affected airports and travel. It's not about red, it's not always about red team and bad guys, right? It's just red team in general. And so what can go wrong? And companies need to think long term and worst case scenarios, and maybe not so worst case scenarios, and plan for those. It comes down to money, right? Do you want to lose money when just having spending a few minutes or spending far less money doing a risk assessment or having a red team exercise, tabletop or red team analysis could have helped you prevent some of these things. Think about money.
It's a really good point. And a lot of times it comes down to brand protection too. Like I work for one of the largest nonprofits now in the risk management space, but there was a big conversation around when the Russia-Ukraine conflict came around. Did we want to continue operations within the Russian space? Could we maybe until the government sanctions really kicked in? But sometimes it was about perception and how your customer is going to perceive your product, whether it's safe, secure, and reliable within those spaces. So, which it comes right back to the almighty dollar, right? That we're talking about these things are important. If you are one of those heartless CEOs that don't think about your people, think about your bottom line, and being able to protect that is absolutely essential.
Exactly. The bottom line is important because, especially for the for-profit companies, right? You might, your brand and marketing might talk about making the world a better place and so forth, but if you're a for-profit company, it comes down to money, right? And so one of the best ways to protect it is to protect that money, that bottom line, is to realize that your reputation and branding is important. One of the things in security, and a lot of security people don't realize this, and a lot of risk owners, the CEOs that realize this, is that one of security's job is not just to protect people and assets, it's to protect the brand and reputation, right? And when you think about it that way, and how important brand and reputation is to a company, it can lead you to realize how important some of this planning and red team and scenario development is. And I could give you one quick example, right, that we didn't talk about, Taiwan and China, right? If you're a company that's based in Taiwan or has a supply chain that touches Taiwan, and you haven't thought about, done some planning, scenario building on what could go wrong, forget about China invading Taiwan, I don't think that will happen, right? I think that's far less likely to happen than a blockade or squeezing of Taiwan. That will make it a much tougher decision for any US president to decide whether to attack China. Just a blockade of China, if you have people based in, if your company organization has people based in Taiwan or a supply chain that touches Taiwan, you are remiss if you have not done detailed planning, business continuity planning or scenario planning or red teaming on how to deal with that eventuality, as an example.
So how real is it today? I know back in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, a lot of corporate type people would get kidnapped when they would go to certain countries. Is that still a real concern today for corporate executives or people that work for rather large corporations?
I think it's less likely now, but it's still a distinct possibility, especially for the lower level folks. And I'm a big fan. I've written articles on this. Listen to the State Department. If you remember, if for both organizations, for both travel, for your company, travel risk management, and also just vacation, listen to the State Department, because kidnappings still happen, even though they're less likely than they were maybe 20, 30 years ago. They still happen. Unlawful detainment is one term the US government uses. I was just on a call with some government folks, a webinar that discussed the same topic just a couple of days ago, I think yesterday actually. And listen to the statement. If the State Department says issues a level 4 warning about a country, level 4 is basically do not travel, don't go there, and if you're already there, leave. There is a misperception that the U.S. government is obligated to do whatever it can to get U.S. citizens out of any country in all cases, no matter what. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that travelers make, because that's not the case. And that's one of my biggest recommendations, is to mitigate against unlawful detainment and kidnapping. Read the State Department travel advisories and register State Department when you travel.
Obviously, kidnapping is a scary thing for executives that travel. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the importance of having sanitized devices when you're going into austere environments like China or France or other countries. How important is that to take care of your equipment? And then my second part of my question is, so kidnapping, though a risk, is it a bigger risk now of more like assassination attempts like we've seen with the insurance executive that was killed not too long ago? Is that something executives should be thinking about and starting to hire people in close protection in order to care for them as they go about their travels?
Yeah, it is. So first, the device issue when traveling to some countries. There was, I had a family member who traveled to China a few years ago. And what I advised this family member was like, hey, you don't take your normal phone, take a burner phone. That family member was going to be there for a few months. Take your burner phone and don't take a computer that you don't want to get rid of when you get back. And same with Russia. And so there's just some countries where, and I know a lot of institutes of higher education, universities, colleges have that rule that, yeah, you need to take a burner phone. And by the way, don't take our official, your school issued phone to China or Russia. And for good reason. Yeah, I would never travel to China or Russia with my main phone. I would use a burner phone. And then once I got back to the port of entry in the U.S., I'd just toss it in the trash. I wouldn't even take it home. In terms of assassination kidnappings, for most people, the risk is low. And this is where risk, what I call risk intelligence is a common term, but basically how we got to understand risk, right? And so I've done some executive protection work. For the vast majority of people in the U.S. who are protectees, whose organizations or family offices hire protection for them, don't need an armed protector, right? For the vast majority of people. If you really, within the U.S., right? If they were going to travel to, say, Syria or some other countries, yeah, you probably want to have someone armed with you. But here in the U.S., for most people, not possible. But depending on your organization, risk intelligence, if you have a good risk intelligence team, whether organically or you've contracted out, you'll quickly realize that some people are much higher risk. The health insurance companies, right? And after a couple of months after the assassination attempt on the UnitedHealthcare worker, I wrote an article in Domestic Preparedness Journal about this. And I wrote that according to his wife, he had received threats based on his company's profile and his perceived role in denying healthcare to people or health insurance claims to people. Some people in some positions are at higher risk. And that's why, and this can affect the bottom line, and that's why some boards require their CEOs and pay for their CEOs to have protection. And that's important. You just have to understand the risk. But it's still there. In that same article I mentioned, I highlighted several cases where CEOs or senior executives were killed or stalked and almost killed by people. And so this includes, I think it was Tim Cook is one example where a female, we stalked him relentlessly. She was later arrested. One entrepreneur was beheaded in his apartment in New York. This is all recent. This is not 30 years ago. This is in the last few years. There's a beheading. And so, yeah, the UnitedHealthcare thing, that was like the most visible recent one. But there have been many cases where, yeah, people were, executives were stalked or killed or kidnapped. And there have been a couple of kidnappings of executives recently. The same goes for celebrities. For celebrities, that's interesting. We could talk about that if you like, but celebrities at a certain level are more vulnerable because of certain limitations. We could talk
about
that.
Were you surprised by the outpouring of people that supported the shooter and the UnitedHealthcare worker or the UnitedHealthcare executive when that happened? Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised, very surprised, actually. And so, of course, it goes without saying that violence is never the answer. And so it'll be an interesting trial for sure. But that relates to how the risk intelligence piece of it, right? It shows you how the fact that there's so much support for him shows you, arguably, in my opinion, shows you how real the risk is for people, for executives in the healthcare insurance industry.
I was shocked by it. Obviously, we have disagreements of being overcharged, but a life is a life and it's important. The last question I have for you, Casey, is in reference to the Charlie Kirk event that transpired not too long ago and the assassination there.
Sure.
Without getting into who he was as a man or if you support him in his political stance or his Christian stance, but just, were you surprised by the gaps that were allowed where the assassination attempt occurred? And what do you think went wrong to produce an environment where that could happen?
Yes, I don't think anyone outside of law enforcement has the details on exactly what went wrong in terms of the mechanics. But what's obvious to me, based on the fact he's no longer with us in the physical body, is that it was a failure of what I call one of the three Ps. I have these three Ps of special event security: protect the performer, protect the pocketbook, protect the patrons, right? You follow those three Ps, everything will be fine. The first one, protect the performer, was obviously a failure, right?
Yeah.
That's obvious, or unless, again, he would still be here. And one of the things that's obvious based on that is just the sight lines and where the shooter probably had to be to take that, what appears to be a fatal shot. And again, there are all kinds of weird things, inconsistencies that we, the public, know very little about this, but about the details. But obviously there was a failure to protect the performer and a sight line issue where there should not have been a clear shot to do what appears to have been done. So you got to weigh, when you're a private citizen, your security team has no authority whatsoever. Private security teams hired by most people who have no authority whatsoever. So there are limitations what you could accomplish, but there's also a lot that you can do and should do. And there's a failure here. So you got to look at, was there a risk intelligence team? How competent was the team? How thorough were there? Was there a manpower issue based on perceived threat? There are all these issues that we don't know. And it reminds me of the Salman Rushdie assassination attempt in, I think it was New York, a couple of years ago. For those unfamiliar, Salman Rushdie is an author who wrote a book that the clerics in Iran hated. And so I think it's called The Satanic Verses, the book he wrote. I think it was 80s, was it? And so they had a fatwa against this author for a while. And then at a speech on stage a few years ago, he was stabbed multiple times. He lost an eye. And if you look at he basically had no protection team there. And so the Charlie Kirk assassination reminds me of that in terms of the complacency and the lack of precautions.
Yeah, it's bizarre that you wouldn't have guys on top of the building. Yeah, that
exactly.
That's a strange one, or at least a drone, or it's hovering something up there. I don't want to get down in conspiracies. This is a conspiracy show, but this particular episode.
and that's why I'd say it comes down to potentially competency. And look, if his protection team was all retired Secret Service guys or other guys who have actual protection experience, law enforcement doesn't count unless you have, that's a big misperception there, unless you've actually had executive protection training as a law enforcement officer. Same with military. I see a lot of job ads that say for protection person, bodyguard, whatever, it says you must have military or law enforcement experience. Yeah, good luck with that, because that's not, most people in law enforcement and military are not trained to do protection. And so it's a completely different skill set a lot of people realize. So you got to wonder what was the case here? And if it was a competent team, was there a manpower issue? Because people are expensive to hire, and maybe they didn't have enough people to place on a rooftop. Who knows? And I don't know if we'll ever know, just for various reasons.
Casey, man, you are amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can our guests find you, and what closing thought do you want to leave everybody with?
Sure. And so, yeah, they can reach me on my website. Contact me through my website. I think it's called colecampbell.com. And yeah, I think that's right.
It's Cole with a K.
K. Yeah, Cole Campbell, CAMPBELL, just like the website. I'm sorry, just like the soup. That's probably the easiest way to reach me. You can use a contact form there. And later on, I could share with you they can reach me on Signal app also. And you could, if you want to put that in your show notes.
Absolutely.
So you have a couple ways to reach me.
Great. Awesome. So anything you want to leave the audience with before you depart?
Yeah, we discussed this a little bit, but yeah, it's an interesting world. That's a cliche usually, right? This world is all going to hell and it's the worst ever been. I usually hate that cliche, but if you look at the number of conflicts going on that started last year and going on now, yeah, it's actually one of the worst in terms of interstate conflict in decades. And so you look at that, you know, terrorism and political violence and polarization, especially in the US, you might think, wow, I'm never leaving the house or I'll be on like red alert every time I leave. And no, I strongly discourage that. Live your lives, do what you do. Don't live in fear. Just be realistic about things. And especially in terms of organizations, invest in that risk intelligence, that professional security team, that geopolitical team, and listen to them. Listen to the experts and you'll be fine.
That's awesome, man. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. Everyone, reach out to KC. He's one of the brightest minds in this industry, and he can help you level up your game. But until next time, we are Zero Signal.
We're out.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.